crossing. The humanitarian situation will deteriorate in Syria's Idlib region. Now, Syria and Russia say the U.S. and Turkey are using the excuse of sending in humanitarian aid to, in reality, supply terrorist groups. Russia says it will veto this authorization at the UN if Washington tries to have it reinstated. Well, stay with us as we take a look at what all of this means on this debate. We're going to cross over to Damascus and start all of this off with Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali, thanks so much for being with us. Now, Muhammad Ali, tell us overall about this situation and what is being said.
Yes, unfortunately, even according, if you ask the Syrians on the streets, if Russia vetoes this resolution, the United States seems that it will continue using such a method in order to bring in so-called humanitarian aid into Syria, because the United States never abided by international law or the UN Charter and its resolutions. It's occupying, for example, parts of Syria. Turkey also is occupying parts of Syria and is supporting directly Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, also known as al-Nusra Front. Now, we have Foreign Minister Faisal al-Maqdad, who said in a televised interview that Washington's policy on cross-border aid is pure hypocrisy, and those efforts of the United States to keep the crossing over there operational are just another attempt to help the terrorists and provide them with all the necessary equipment to prolong the war in Syria. And Maqdad confirmed that the border crossing activities, not just the aid by Turkey and the United States, are a violation of Syria's sovereignty, and weapons are actually being sent under the pretext of humanitarian aid to those terrorists. For example, I met a terrorist and interviewed him while he was going out via bus in 2018 from Eastern Ghouta into Idlib. I interviewed him, and he said that all of the terrorist groups there are thieves, and they used to take all of the humanitarian aid that comes from Western countries for themselves and for their families and do not distribute them to the civilians. Maqdad also finally said that if the Western countries really care about Syrians, they should lift their sanctions that are preventing Syria from getting food and medical supplies for the Syrians.
Right, indeed. Thanks so much for that update. That's Muhammad Ali, Press TV's correspondent out of Damascus. I'd like to welcome my guests, one of my guests to the program, Mark Taliano, activist and author of Voices from Syria out of Hamilton, Ontario. Thanks so much for being with us. What do you make of all of this? On the one hand, the UN is saying that they need to be able to extend this authorization in order to make sure that the humanitarian needs of people are met in Idlib. On the other hand, we see something that seems to be different, and we're hearing something totally different from the Syrian government as well as the Russian government. Your take?
Well, it's supreme war criminality is what it is. And there are a lot of complicit parties in this, including the UN, and including the Western media cartels, who obscure the truth from Western domestic audiences. It's very it should be common knowledge, simply because Western officials have admitted that they support al-Qaeda. Idlib is a al-Qaeda central. Okay, Brett McGirt admitted it's the largest AQ haven since 9/11. U.S. Ambassador James Jeffrey just admitted al-Qaeda is a U.S. asset. Okay, there's nothing new about this. We have been documenting this for since before the beginning of this regime change war, and regime change wars are supreme international crimes. And so this is happening beneath the purview of the United Nations. It's happening with the support of Canada and other coalition countries that are waging criminal war against Syria. The citizens in Idlib are basically being held hostage by al-Qaeda and affiliated terrorists. And this has been happening throughout the war. The terrorists will hoard the food given to them by the West, including Canada, and they will extort money from the Syrian citizens. This is why Syrians reject this regime change war. This is why Syrians overwhelmingly support their president against U.S. Imperialism and U.S.-led imperialism and against the U.S. coalition terrorists.
Okay. Well, let me welcome my next guest out of Damascus, international lawyer Arnaud Develi. Thank you so much for being with us. Your take on this overall situation of what is being said and what is actually happening, because on the one hand, Syria is saying that, you know, their territory is occupied. That is illegal, and is illegal according to the United Nations. It should be. And also that, one, U.S. and Turkey should get off of Syrian soil. The United States is in parts of Syria that, of course, is oil-rich and controlling much of the oil and also much of the agricultural sector. Why don't we see more interaction from the United Nations when dealing with Syria's sovereignty?
Well, I would say that the UN is actually not acting neutral. The UN has been instrumentalized for years now, not only in Syria, but in other theaters of operations. The latest instance being the inscription of Ansarallah on the so-called shame list by Gutierrez at the exact same moment when Gutierrez was running for a second term. And in that respect, the IAEA has also been instrumentalized. The OPCW has also been instrumentalized. So what we're seeing is basically a disintegration of the international order as exemplified by the UN. But at the same time, the UN being the only sole legitimate organization upon which the world community, and not the international community, as it were, has been relying on for the last 75 years, the Russians, just to cite a party among others, has been trying to retain a legalistic approach to things and bring to the fore the issues that, to begin with, humanitarian assistance should not be politicized. And this is what we've seen here with this.
So what does that mean? Sorry to jump in here. So what exactly does that mean? You say basically the world order is basically disintegrating, but then on the other hand, the United Nations is the legitimate representative of nations. So where does that leave nations, for example, like Syria, whose rights, of course, are being trampled on by some of the main players in the world, and it seems even that supported by the UN?
Well, it means that the only way that Syrian has to reclaim his right, and that includes the territories in the Idlib province and the northeast, is to mount resistance. Nothing else will do, because the force of arms on the ground will dictate the terms of a political settlement. As simple as that.
Okay.
Yes. Well, yes.
Go ahead, Mark. You want to say something?
Well, I agree. I agree. Unfortunately, that's the only thing that will work at this juncture.
Well, okay. So resistance is the only thing that will work, that you're saying. But again, we're seeing, I mean, this has been going on a while now in Syria, Mark, and we're seeing then, when we look at this latest move, talking about these trucks crossing over the border from Turkey to Syria, this is nothing new, but why is it that after the United States has been involved in this situation for so long and actually has not been successful in the way they want it to, that they are just continuing to use the same playbook? What's the ultimate goal? At first it was regime change, and I'm sure they would still like to do that, but that's not likely. Is it what? Just creating chaos? Is it destabilization? How do you see it?
I see this in the same terms that the former Ramsey Clark saw this, and that is that evil, invisible lobbies are controlling Washington and Western governments right now. And they're okay. So Syria has strong allies. Syria has strong support from its population. And some of these so-called invisible lobbies include the mainstream media cartels, which obscure the truth. We have all sorts of admissions from Washington itself that Washington supports ISIS and Al Qaeda. Okay, the mainstream media is actually a PR platform for Al-Qaeda. because the mainstream media, as an example, obscures these facts and confuses these facts. What will happen? I am confident that Syria and its allies will eventually reoccupy all of their occupied territories, and that and I am confident of this because I saw the support of Syrians for their government. And I am confident of this because Syrians know full well that any alternative is a total, complete disaster. Many Syrians, as in Syrians right now being held hostage in Western proxy in Idlib, for example, and all the formerly terrorist-occupied areas, the people who were held hostage now rejoice that they have been liberated. So they know what enslavement by Western proxies feels like, and they know what liberation feels like, and they will not forget that.
Well, what about that, Arnold? I mean, Mark talked about, as far as the mass media and basically being an extension type of PR for these terrorist groups. How should this be dealt with? Because, for example, United Nations right now is saying that 1,000 trucks are crossing the border every month and actually taking this humanitarian aid in, taking in food, and, of course, when they're talking about that on the media, it's as if now the Russians are saying that they're going to block this, as if the Russians do not want food to get to these individuals, as well as Damascus itself. So where do we stand? I mean, how do we deal with this type of wrong information that is out there coming from the mainstream media and then supported by the United Nations itself?
Yeah, you actually underlined it. I mean, the mass media, the mainstream media, as it were, is mostly an extension, a mouthpiece of the various lobbies and arms manufacturers. This is well documented. Former employees of the mass media, the mainstream media, have come out and all wrote about it. That, you know, basically they are CIA figureheads. They get their talking points, and if you deviate ever so slightly from those talking points, your history. So it's just a job, and the propaganda is but an arm of the globalist military industrial complex. We are more than ever before in an hybrid warfare. They instrumentalized the UN, they instrumentalized the very rule of law. As we can see in various courtrooms across Europe, where everything is more like the political manipulation of political processes and legal processes. So there's not even the pretense nowadays to hide behind some formal processes which would appear to be somewhat neutral. The machine, the narrative of the machine, as I call it, is unraveling. They are facing internal contradictions that have been accumulating for the last three decades now. And the point is, what do we do? We have our own media. We have our own, the mainstream media does not have the monopoly anymore on the narrative. And we saw this in a very exemplified fashion as, 3 days ago, 33 networks and websites of the resistance were the victim of hacking. So basically, this means only one thing, is that, the truth is getting through somewhat in spite of their billions of dollars and their nice sets and their expensive wardrobes. People are thirsty for the truth. There's a popular commonsensical approach to the way things are, whether it's about the constant permanent warfare state or the health situation, as they call it, for the last 15 months, people are getting somewhat the idea, the hint, that there's something drastically wrong between how the media tries to portray reality and how commonsensical people get to experience it on a day-to-day basis.
Well, Mark, speaking of the media, of course, when we talk about the Bab al-Hawa checkpoint, It takes me back to especially 2014 and my good colleague, Serena Shem, here at Press TV,
yes.
Of course, who was reporting from there at that time and saying that UN food program trucks were being used to take in terrorists and take the equipment, supplies into Syria. And we saw that basically nothing was said, nothing was done. Again, we're talking about the mainstream media, and of course, a couple of days later, unfortunately, Serena lost her life. So now here we are, fast forwarding 7 years later, and we're seeing this same scenario repeating itself. What has changed in those 7 years in your perspective, 2014 to 2021, as far as the resistance and as far as the opposite axis of the resistance in Syria?
The axis of resistance, in other which they resist, people who resist, countries who resist the legitimate Syrian government, they represent international law. They represent nation-state sovereignty. They represent civilization. And the West and its proxies represent barbarism. And Syria is, this is one reason why this victory for Syria is and will be so important, is because it is on the side of truth, peace, and justice. And now Syria's allies are stronger. And this hybrid war will no doubt continue, but as my colleague mentioned, there is some desperation now. They're taking websites off the air. People are seeing with this COVID op that our governments are not, Western governments themselves are not supporting the people, Western people, okay? Western people are slowly becoming aware of this. These globalists do not represent our interests. Canada is no longer a democracy. We are living beneath totalitarian rule in many respects, sometimes more than others. Okay, but of course, again, the media is an arm of the, what I call the controllers. And the controllers are not the Western politicians, unfortunately. Well, the Western propositions are puppets for these globalist controllers. But it can be brought down, and Syria has shown to the world, and is showing to the world, that the forces of truth and justice and civilization can prevail and can become ascendant. And I believe that this will continue to be the case. I believe that Washington-led coalition is on its last legs there, and that Syria will regain occupied territories and its sovereignty and its independence.
Arnold, your take. I mean, I want to compare in the very beginning of the onslaught that was on Syria from these terrorists from so many countries in the world, compared from the beginning of that until now, and these two different points of this axis, again, the axis of resistance, and of course, as you said, those representing the globalists, changes since the beginning of this conflict or this onslaught till now?
Well, the changes is that over time, I mean, I always compare the Syrian situation to Stalingrad during World War II. This is like the turning of the tide, and the reason why we're seeing now this kind of insistence on the globalists in trying to press on using various means, maybe under cover of the pandemic, as I call it, well, in isolating the different composing segment of the resistance axis. They understand that if they lose this one, they're losing the whole marble. This one is for the whole marble. And this idea that China is building this new Eurasian economic sphere is terrifying them. And they're making more and more mistakes now. They seem to be in full panic, to be honest. And we might be seeing, as time goes on, an acceleration of this liquefaction process. They're going to dissolve in their own hinterland because the people there, one, they stop realizing that they've been had, that the game is up, and that they're going to be basically chipped and ran and instrumentalized as products themselves. People are gonna be crazy, are going crazy. People are gonna blow up. I mean, when one has nothing to lose, one basically tries to take his enemy down with him. And so I think this is all coming to a head right now. And we have to remain extremely vigilant because the beast is wounded, but the beast is never more dangerous than when it's wounded and backed against the wall.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this debate. Mark Taliano, activist and author, Voices from Syria out of Hamilton, Ontario, and Arnaud Demele, international lawyer out of Damascus.
Thank you.
And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for staying with us. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فجعلناهم غثاء فبعدا للقوم الظالمين.
So the shriek seized them in truth, and we made them as plant stubble. Then away with the wrongdoing people.
Brothers and sisters, the verse under discussion was the 41st verse of the chapter. فَأَخَذَتْهُمُ الصَّيْحَةُ بِالْحَقِّ فَجَعَلْنَاهُمْ غُثَاءً فَبُعْدًا لِلْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ. And the blast overtook them with justice, and we made them into a scum, so away with the unjust people. So this is what happens when the Prophet Salih alayhi salam invoked unto his Lord, and he said, رَبِّنْ صُرْنِي بِمَا كَذَّبُونَ. Help me against what they belie. They
did not believe in him, they said that he is forging a lie about Allah, and we will not believe in him, they said. They said that we only live in this world, we die in this world, and there is nothing, as the Prophet says, as a resurrection and hereafter. In the previous program, however, we said that there was, based on narrations, there was only one person who committed this crime and actually slaughtered this camel as the sign of the prophethood. But the Holy Quran uses a plural pronoun and says, فَأَقَرُوهَا, they slaughtered her. So Islam sees ideological and intellectual affinities as very profound and extensive, to the extent that they are not limited by time and place. A close reading of this meaningful speech of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha will be enough, I assume. When Imam Ali alayhi salam overcame the enemy in the war of Jamal, and his comrades were very happy with the victory of Islam over ignorance and division, one of them said, "I wish my brother had participated in this war, so he too would have been able to see what success and victory Allah had given you." Imam alayhi salam replied, "Tell me, was your brother with us in his heart?" The man said, "Yes." "In that case, he was with us," Imam Ali alayhi salam said. And then he continued, "Rather, in this army of ours, even those persons were also present who are still in the loins of men and wombs of women. Shortly, time will bring them out and faith will get strength through them." So this is what we can conclude from living in the community and society when something wrong is being done.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Another aspect of the verse to be discussed is that there is a relationship between the Quranic word itraf, which is the life of aristocracy, and the infidelity that denies the meeting with the Almighty Allah. And it is true, actually. Usually, those who live in this type of life enjoy a larger degree of freedom to pursue whatever kinds of sensual gratification and animal pleasure they wish. Accepting the divine guardianship and the resurrection can be accounted as a barrier to this kind of life. Accepting and believing in resurrection and hereafter would disrupt the life of these aristocrats and would make the people brave enough to stand against them. I mean, they are having so happy lives. Why would they
believe in something that would disrupt this living. So they remove the yoke of Allah's servitude from their necks, and they deny the origin and the resurrection. And as we read in the verses, they insist that worldly, physical life is the only life there is. In the previous verses we read to you, they said, "In huwa illa hayatuna dunya." There is nothing but this world. We live in this world and we die in this one. So they call a liar whoever claims the contrary, whoever believes that there is something such as hereafter. They believe that this is the only moment they have, and as such they must pick a flower from every garden, enjoy themselves on every occasion in these few days of life, and in this manner they justify their offenses and their wrong actions. This way of thought, this ideology, is what we are going to talk about more, inshallah, in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The World with Reporters.
The month of Tir on the Iranian calendar marks a series of tragic events that occurred during the early years of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. From the U.S. Army's shooting down of an Iranian airliner in 1988 to the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror group are examples of the incidents that fall in the same time frame, between late June and early July.
The U.S. footprints can be traced in almost all of the incidents that occurred during this period. The events were so harsh and fateful that are still remembered by Iranians after decades. Every year, Iran marks June the 26th to July the 2nd as the week of American human rights. As a jab, that questions the U.S. standing as rights advocate.
The week-long occasion is associated with nationwide ceremonies. Each day commemorates one of the incidents. The first day marks the attempted assassination of the then-president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981. The second day marks the bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran in the same year. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti. The event is known in Iran as the 7th of Tir disaster. This incident was also carried out by the MKO terror group. In 2012, the United States removed the MKO from the list of terrorist organizations, something which is interpreted as Washington's dual take on terrorism.
The United States' hostility toward Iran became more evident after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. It supported Iraq's Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran, and also funded and supported the MKO terrorists in numerous attacks on Iranian people. So we review these incidents during this week to let the world know that the U.S. is not a defender of human rights.
The week also marks Iraq's 1987 chemical attack on the city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province during the 8th year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran.
At least 110 people were killed, and 5,000 more were injured in the attack, which was carried out using chemical weapons provided by the U.S. and some other Western countries.
The chemical bombardment of Sardash was one of the most heinous crimes against humanity. Sardash was the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki to become the target of weapons of mass destruction. Former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed a huge arsenal of chemical weapons, which were produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Observers say Washington portrays itself as the defender of human rights across the globe, but it uses the issue as an excuse to exert pressure on other countries, while closing its eyes on its own rights violations. Organizers hope the week-long ceremonies will help shine a light on the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin has been sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for the murder of African-American George Floyd during an arrest in May 2020 in the city of Minneapolis. This came after a jury found 45-year-old Chauvin guilty on April 20th of unintentional second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. President Joe Biden reacted to the court's decision, saying the prison sentence seemed to be appropriate. But civil rights activists, as well as members of Floyd's family, had a different point of view.
This sentencing is the longest sentence we've seen, but it is not justice, because George Floyd is in a grave tonight, even though Chauvin will be in jail.
When you think about George being murdered in cold blood with a knee on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, execution style in broad daylight, 22 and a half years is not enough.
This right here is this 22-year sentence they gave this man. It's a slap on the wrist. We serving a life sentence of not having them in our life, and that hurts me to death.
We didn't get what we wanted. We definitely wanted to see the maximum penalty, but however, as they've already stated, we do have the federal ahead of us.
Experts say Chauvin's trial was a stunt to distract African Americans from their main demands.
I think what we're seeing here is more bait and switch and distraction. When they focus, and the media is complicit in this, the U.S. corporate media, because what they do when they focus on trials like this, they're trying to distract what the ultimate goal and the primary goal of the movements, the uprisings, are.
The video of the white officer kneeling on the neck of the unarmed black man in handcuffs for more than 9 minutes sparked outrage in the U.S. and around the world. However, Floyd was just one of thousands of black victims murdered by U.S. police. According to research and advocacy group Mapping Police Violence, nearly 7,800 people were killed by police in the United States from 2013 to 2020. A disproportionate number of victims were African Americans. The group says black Americans are 2.5 times as likely to be killed by police as white people. Meanwhile, inspired by the verdict in George Floyd's case, relatives of other police brutality victims in the U.S. have also come forward demanding their cases reopened. But as many see the recent court ruling against the murderer of Floyd far from proportional to the crime he has committed, justice in the U.S. society seems to remain as elusive as ever.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah began his televised speech by denouncing the U.S. administration's decision to seize and block dozens of website domains connected to Iranian and regional media outlets.
It's not coincidental that these websites which were seized are media outlets that had a major role in supporting the Palestinians in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. They all have a clear position from the Zionist enemy and the American hegemony over the region. These outlets are critical of sedition and terrorism, specifically Takfiri terrorism. This gives us and the free people of the world another piece of evidence against the false claims of the U.S. administration, which claims to defend freedom of speech and freedom of opinion.
Said Nasrallah also criticized U.S. statements that attempt to incite the Lebanese army against the resistance. Said Nasrallah noted that U.S. officials have tried to justify their humble support to the Lebanese army by stressing that this assistance is aimed at giving the army leverage to confront Hezbollah. This, Said Nasrallah says, will not happen since the National Army is the main guarantor for peace in the country. On another note, the resistance leader explained how Hezbollah has been exerting an effort to mediate talks for the formation of the cabinet.
All efforts in the country must come together to form a government and to pull the country out of this dilemma. Since Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri was named by most members of parliament, we have been working on a quick formation of the cabinet. We have been supportive of an initiative from Speaker Barry, and we will work on finding resolutions to the last few disagreements in the talks.
Experts believe Said Nasrallah's words and sufferings of the people lining up at gas stations and pharmacies should be an incentive for the officials to find solutions.
Said Nasrallah said there is no magical solution, and he asserts that the crisis should be disintegrated and resolved one by one until the government is reestablished. If we want to go back to the state where the government collects taxes and the citizens practice their rights and responsibilities in paying taxes, where there are investments in the country again and we create more job opportunities, all of these issues need political stability, and political stability will be the only first step to genuinely solve the many crises in the country.
Said Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah has accomplished all the administrative and logistic preparations for importing gasoline and fuel from Iran to Lebanon in case the state fails to cover the fuel shortage. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Luxurious Avonfield apartments located at Park Lane, Mayfair in London. The family of thrice-elected former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, has been staying here for decades. A trial court sentenced Nawaz Sharif for 10 years in 2018 for owning these flats, which the judge found were purchased through money laundering and ill-gotten money. Sharif left Pakistan in late 2019 after being released, allegedly on the basis of false medical reports, to once again reside in this palatial residence. To the shock of the former Prime Minister, back in Pakistan, now a high court set aside his appeal and upheld the verdict of the trial court. Sharif was declared a fugitive of law by the court when he backtracked his commitment with the high court to return home within a few weeks after the medical treatment. This has now led High Court to reject his appeal for failing to return home despite his earlier pledge with the court.
I think Nawaz Sharif should not have fled the country and now that he has been declared as fugitive or an absconder, that's not good for him. That will actually soil his political reputation. For now, Nawaz Sharif is in trouble and politically, I think, his position has become more precarious.
The High Court verdict has come as a major political victory for ruling party of Prime Minister Imran Khan, who came into power in 2018 with the pledge to prosecute Nawaz Sharif and other opposition leaders on corruption charges.
This verdict is a victory for the people of Pakistan, and this verdict is the victory to the ruling party's anti-corruption campaign. We believe Nawaz Sharif must return the money he looted from the people of Pakistan.
The former Prime Minister still has one chance to appeal with the Supreme Court of Pakistan to set aside his conviction. But for that to happen, Sharif must return home. Otherwise, legal experts believe that the top court may also reject his appeal. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Shocking footage filmed on the 18th of June, Iran's election day, shows Iranian expats being attacked outside polling stations up and down the UK. Victims included women and the elderly, the perpetrators, supporters of anti-Iran terrorist groups, including the MEK, communists, and Shah royalists.
Videos released on social media show fanatic protesters hurling Islamophobic abuse and even physically assaulting voters in cities including Birmingham, Manchester and here in London too.
One victim reached out to tell us about her ordeal.
As soon as I got near the embassy, I was wearing the hijab, obviously, and there crowd started roaring and screaming. And they got louder as they saw me, obviously, going to vote. Calling me names, calling my family names, cursing my mother, my father. I heard a rock hit the ground. I didn't look back because I was shaking at that time as well. One of them said to me, and funnily enough, the policeman was there, but obviously he couldn't understand Farsi. He was telling me if I had a knife, I would cut you in pieces right here, right now. I was so shaking with fear. Since then, I've suffered with anxiety since that day. I said to myself, I should have left, but I stood my ground. I said, why should I leave? And the people coming, I said, why are you calling me names? They said, we call you names because you deserve it.
Britain boasts about being a defender of democracy on the world stage, but these violent scenes suggest that the UK failed miserably to protect democratic rights of Iranians inside its own borders. Despite these attempts, Iran's election went ahead, with President-elect Sayed Ibrahim Raisi coming out on top. Robert Carter, London.
It's the world's second most populous nation, and the figures of COVID-19 infection cases are rising on a daily basis. The cities are bustling as the country is picking up pace as the world's fastest growing major economies. But in all this hustle bustle and race of survival, an important aspect of life is on stake, and that is mental health. The second wave of COVID-19 has altered the lifestyle of millions across India, who now are struggling in silence. Reports suggest more than 70% of those in the age group of 18 to 24 are suffering from some form of depression. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has ignited the crisis further, as many are facing financial and social hardships. According to psychological experts, economic and social pressures combined with a lack of appropriate mental health facilities is a major reason behind this new epidemic, which has now started exploding due to the coronavirus pandemic. Based on reports, the economic cost of mental illness in India is expected to be more than $1 trillion by 2030.
COVID-19 has impacted a lot. A lot means, you can say, everyone, almost everyone, because one or the other way, everyone has been affected. Whether it's the infection has caused, or the mental health, or the other ways, because the businesses has shut down.
Health experts say all disorders are linked to a fast-paced lifestyle, stress, complexities of living, breakdown of support systems, and challenges of economic instability. They say the COVID pandemic has added fuel to the fire with depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, and substance abuse being common in most people.
One must go for yoga daily. Yoga, you have to do proper yoga. Then breathing exercises are there. They have to do at least half an hour to 1 hour so that the blood circulation towards brain increases.
COVID-19 lockdowns impacted people from all walks of life and age groups. Now they're finding it hard to deal with consequences of the pandemic-induced lockdowns. Many turn to drugs and alcohol, while others prefer religious therapies and yoga. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Britain's travel industry is frustrated and nervous. Protesting around the country on June 23rd, people whose jobs rely on international travel, now only working at 10% capacity. They want more countries on the so-called green list to save jobs.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And then why put some on the green list and then take them off? Like, say we booked a holiday to Portugal. We were supposed to be there this week and we've cancelled it because it went amber and it was going to cost another £1,000 in COVID tests.
The restrictions are now crazy, so I'm stuck in England for quite a long time, and I wish to travel back to my country as I haven't seen my mum for 2 years.
Green means arrivals to the UK do not need to self-isolate, but have to take a test before and after they travel. Amber means self-isolating at home for up to 10 days, and red means quarantining at a hotel paid for by the travelers.
In the past few days, some government officials suggested double-jabbed passengers from amberless countries could be exempt from quarantining.
We're also looking to see how we can replace the protections that are currently there with the restrictions with protections that come from the vaccine, with respect to international travel as well. But it is more difficult freeing up international travel.
And difficult it will be when it comes to the willingness of other countries to let British tourists in. Germany has called on all EU countries to make British travelers quarantine on arrival to slow the spread of the Delta variant. All this as the UK recorded more than 16,000 new COVID cases Wednesday, the highest figure since early February, most of them caused by the Delta variant first discovered in India. There were also 19 deaths. The travel industry is yet to react to the government announcement. But with countries moving up and down the UK government's list, British travelers have to think again before they take a gamble. Saeed Puriza, London.
As anti-Westminster sentiment continues to rise, another part of Britain is entering the fight to break away from the UK. Cornwall, located on the southwest of the island, is witnessing the start of a new pro-independence advocacy group which aims to revive a lesser-known campaign for Cornish independence.
All under one banner's Cur Now is the latest branch in a wider organisation which already has roots in Scotland and Wales. In both countries, All Under One Banner has achieved significant success in opening up the debate on independence. Locals in Cornwall are hoping to achieve the same.
Many Cornish people, who are recognised as a Celtic minority, have various grievances with the English-centric London rule, including a lack of funding and a systematic destruction of an ancient culture.
That's a good way of explaining it. We're a long colonised place, possibly longer than the Welsh, who also probably feel that they've been colonised as well. But we've recovered that history, and that's one of our greatest successes. And the greatest challenge now is decolonising the history and explaining it to Anglo-Saxon ears.
In past campaigns, activists have been branded as nationalists who hate the English, a claim rejected by locals.
I've got no problem with the English or with any other nationality at all. What I have a problem with is the way that possibly we are represented through them. And the way sometimes we are talked down to and treated by them. But no, there's no problem at all. We have so many friends from all over the world down here.
For now, Cornish independence is a minority view, but lifelong campaigners believe things are changing.
I think we're already getting there in terms of greater autonomy, understanding the need for it. The next question is how to get it, and obviously there are political ways of getting it, but there's also a need for people to go out and campaign for it.
The idea of Scotland or Wales breaking away has sent shivers down Number 10. This latest development in Cornwall will surely only worsen Downing Street's fears. Robert Carter, London.
The US Justice Department committed a new flagrant violation of the freedom of the press and blocked several regional outlets' websites, including the Yemeni channel Al Masira and Iran's Press TV, claiming they are linked to what it calls Iranian disinformation efforts. Yemen has condemned this move, saying it proves that the US calls for freedom of speech are lies.
The seizure of some of the websites affiliated with the resistance front comes amid the media war. The Saudi-led coalition has been trying since the beginning of its war on Yemen to cover up its crimes committed against Yemenis and to mislead world public opinion.
Yemen's Ministry of Information said the U.S. government seizure of a few websites confirmed the strength of the media of the resistance and proved that these websites revealed the true face of the U.S., including its participation in the brutal Saudi war on Yemen.
We condemn the seizure of some websites affiliated with the resistance front. This move shows that these websites have been strong enough to influence the American public opinion by releasing the realities on the ground. It reveals the falsehood of American claims about democracy and freedom of speech. Certainly, there are solutions to this blocking and the websites will be running again.
Ali Al-Shara'i, the manager of Al-Masira website, said this move revealed the weakness of the U.S. even though it owns thousands of media outlets.
This step reveals the great weakness that the United States is suffering from, even though it owns thousands of websites, satellite channels, newspapers, and radio stations. However, it was unable to withstand a few channels with limited capabilities which convey the truth as it is and express the opinion of the free people in this world.
Experts believe that this step is part of a media war of the U.S. government against the media outlets of the resistance. They said these attacks will persist and the resistance access should be ready for further violations.
Yemenis say the freedom of speech is a fundamental right for all free people of the world, and the United States has no right to deny individuals or communities this right. They believe that such attacks will promote the free media outlets to continue exposing the U.S. policies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Have our own special fears or phobias, which emerge once in a while and affect our life to some extent. And I myself suffer from carcerophobia or fear of prisons. Yes, prison. The sound which that cruel metal gate makes. Closes the gate which separates one from the outside world, the loneliness behind the bars. Oh my God, how did these thoughts came to attack my mind? Oh, I'm better now. You know what? These thoughts are the outcome of what I've thought all the day long. Yes, because I have planned to visit a prison today. Harun prison. Maybe this visit makes me overcome my strange fear. Harun prison, or Harun al-Rashid prison, is located 13 kilometers east of Tehran. Harun prison is one of the historical monuments of Shahr-e-Rey, which was built after the advent of Islam in this city. Shahr-e-Rey is one of the ancient cities of the world, which dates back to Mids era. This city has many historical monuments. Today, Shahr-e-Rey is one of the municipal districts of the city of Tehran. Harun prison is a prison from Buyid dynasty. However, according to French architect and archaeologist André Godard, this monument dates back to Seljuqid era and has been one of the military fortifications of that era.
I am now
walking on the foothill of Meskarabad Mountains. Here, there are old huge plane trees, and a few steps away, there are pomegranate and fig orchards. I have to walk a little more in order to reach the Harun prison. If I hadn't promised to myself to visit this prison, I would prefer to visit the fig orchards of this region.